This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Well, welcome back to the Jodcast, Stuart. I think you did an interview here in 2007 about the National Astronomy Meeting that was held in Preston.
Did indeed, yes. Yeah.
Well, thanks for agreeing to come back and be interviewed again. This time you're going to tell us a bit about some astronomy, some research that you've been involved with over the last, well, several years, in fact. It's an interesting thing called, is it Sakurai's object?
Sakurai's object, that's right. V4334 Sagittarius.
Ah, so it's in the constellation of Sagittarius. Yeah. Right. So this thing was something that brightened, well, first, it's like a star that brightened back in 1996, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So we saw it brighten in somebody saw it brighten in 1996, got up to sort of 10.8 visual magnitude. But when we look back on some past patrol plates and images, we discovered it had been brightening for about 6 months by that point, before anybody noticed. And it sat at that sort of magnitude for 3 or 4 years, but the spectrum changed dramatically, particularly infrared. So it spent some time looking like an arc or Bohr star, and some time looking at a carbon star. Lots of molecules formed, rapidly changing over a few years. Initially, I was interested in it because I was a classical nova researcher, and it looked like a nova just from the way it brightened. But when you looked at the spectrum, it was something completely different.
All right. So remind me what a nova is then?
So a nova is an explosion on a white dwarf in a binary star. It's a very hot explosion. It ejects enormous amount of gas, and it brightens. The star brightens by 10 or 15 magnitudes, say, in a few hours, and then declines over several months, depending on how fast and energetic it is. But in this, and the spectrum is lots of hot lines. In this case, you saw a very different spectrum. In particular, an absence of hydrogen. And then Don Polarco at Queen's University looked at it and discovered a nebula, a planetary nebula. And both of those put together suggested this is this thing that had been dubbed a born-again giant star.
Right.
And these are white dwarfs, probably coming from a star much like the Sun, but after the Sun's left its main sequence, finished burning hydrogen in its core, it goes through a giant phase, eventually kicks off the envelope of the giant phase, and you get a planetary nebula, and at the core of the planetary nebula is a hot star. And that gradually cools down and fades away to become a white dwarf. But in maybe 25% of cases, there's enough hydrogen on the surface to reignite. And the first stage is that you actually have a helium shell flash, and the helium ignites. It ingests all the hydrogen, and that drives the white dwarf all the way back to a giant phase. So that remnant of the old envelope reinflates or inflates to form this new giant star. And that's where the brightening comes from, because it inflates so rapidly and becomes such a large object that it's very, very bright.
So this thing looks like a planetary nebula. It has this sort of
It has a planetary nebula around it, and then in the middle there's now a giant star rather than the old hot stars. And actually there's evidence in the last few years that we've seen the birth of a new planetary nebula, a second planetary nebula. And when you look out there, you do find planetary nebulae that are hydrogen deficient, so probably have gone through this phase.
Right.
And even some that have nested, you know, a small planetary nebula inside, evidence of a very large. Of course, planetary nebulae aren't visible for more than a few thousand years in their bright phase. So the one we're seeing around this one is 17,000 years old, which is about what you'd expect it to be. And then this new one's forming now.
Right.
It's also been called stellar evolution while you wait, because the thing moves across Hertzsprung-Russell diagram in only a few years, two or three years. It's been a prediction of stellar evolution theory for many, many years. But the prediction always was that it would take a few decades, maybe a century, to go through this process, and we saw it happen in two or three years. So it's already started to change our understanding at this stage. Because it happens in 25% of solar mass stars and below, so 25% of most stars, it's probably very common in that most stars do it, but because it lasts a very short time, you don't see many of them.
Right.
And that also means it can have an effect, if it does any strange things, it can have all sorts of effects on chemical evolution of the interstellar medium. So, for example, in this star, we see a lot of 13 carbon, particular isotope of carbon, much more so than we see in normal stars. Possibly, Albert Zylstra at Manchester, at this institute, has suggested that it's one of the two main sources of that particular isotope, which has then is incorporated onto other stars and has a big effect on their evolution as well. So the star observation, he spent several years at magnitude 10.8, but now you won't find it because it's at magnitude 24.
Oh, okay. So that's a very faint star.
Very, very faint star. Mm-hmm. And we tried to detect it with a very large telescope, to 8 meters, literally what's called the very large telescope, 8 meters telescope, and not really been able to get adequate detection.
In Chile.
And also with the Southern African Large Telescope.
Okay. So why is it? So what brightness would it have been before 1996?
Before 1996, looking back, it's about 17th magnitude. That's okay. That's a pretty faint star, but it's accessible with any decent size professional telescope, certainly. The helium flash and the subsequent expansion took it to 10.8 magnitude. We think it probably still is about 10.8 magnitudes.
Oh, okay.
But there's a dust shroud in front of it, a very dense, thick dust shroud. You actually see, it was very, very red before it faded away.
Right, so this is a material that was thrown off the white dwarf in this new helium flash.
So this helium flash ejected what will become a new planetary nebula.
Okay.
And that got to a certain... When it gets to a certain extent, certain distance from the central star, it cools down enough for solid particles to form, and that's what we call dust. It's soot, really.
Yeah.
And
mainly carbon, or...?
Yes, it's a carbonation dust. So dust comes in sort of silicate forms, where it's got lots of oxygen combined, or in carbonation forms. This is a carbonation form. Comes probably from the carbon-bearing molecules we were seeing earlier in its evolution, just before this happened. So that means we haven't been able to see the star directly for many years, maybe 10 years now.
Right.
But what we could do for it in the early stages is look at the heat of the dust, which basically captured all the energy from the star and then re-radiated it in the infrared, and we can use the infrared to measure the gradual bright changing of the star and model that. And then more recently we've used radio observations to look inside the dust, because the radio waves come straight through the dust shell. So I had that idea again a few years ago, and we followed that up, and you can see things like that radio emission originally came from shocked gas, so gas expanding and hitting other gas and heating up. That leads to a gradually declining radio emission. That's what we saw. And then a few years ago, 2006 or 7 or so, we saw it rebrightening.
In the radio.
And when you work out why that should be, you model why that should be, it turns out to be because the star is now reheating. So as a white dwarf, it was a few tens of thousands of Kelvin. As a giant, it was a few thousand, 2,000-3,000 Kelvin. But we're already seeing it reheating and therefore ionising material and creating a radio emission back to sort of tens of thousands of Kelvin in only a few years.
Hmm.
And the model, there are different models, different explanations of why this is happening, all theoretical, computational models that predict different rates of the reheating and different evolutions over the next 20 years. So I'm expecting to spend my whole career observing this thing every so often, just to see how it changes. And of course, if the dust clears, then we will be having a real exciting time taking new data of what's actually happening with this object that's never really been seen. There are one or two other objects out there in the sky that were seen as novae in the past that we now think probably are these sorts of objects, and they give us some clue about where it's going.
Okay. So is it so the reason it sort of seems to be getting hotter again, this star in the middle, is because it's shrinking back down to be more like the size of the white dwarf?
That's right. So if you imagine it as having a shell of gas that's blowing away and is gradually becoming detached from the central star, and that gas is also becoming, within the dust shroud, is becoming transparent, and therefore you're seeing a hot star in the middle.
Mm.
So what we're seeing in the radio is gas inside the dust shell.
Mm.
That is being ionised and heated up by the central star, and therefore getting hotter. And eventually it'll presumably result in a small planetary nebula which will be expanding with a hot star in the middle. And the prediction is basically it retraces its evolution, a slightly different path across the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, and then will really cool down to become a white dwarf.
Mm.
But at least one prediction suggests it will go through a loop again. It'll go through another loop round the bright part of the Hertzsprung-Russell diagram, through a hot phase and back to a cool phase again. And those sorts of predictions are the things we're trying to test with these. So a fairly small number of observations we can actually make.
Is this type of evolution something that's predicted to happen for all stars, really? Which stars go through this, do you think?
Will the
Sun go through this, for example?
The Sun could go through this. So the predictions say... But because the difficulty with the predictions is what we're finding out is they're not predicting what we're seeing very well. But they suggest maybe 25% of all stars in that sort of mass range, so the same sort of mass of the Sun and below, will go through this stage, or a stage like this.
And what is it that means that, why do some stars go through this helium shell flash and others don't?
I'm not sure we properly understand that. I know I certainly don't. But it's to do with whether you're able to eject all the material from the envelope. So, so a giant star is a very, very dense core and a diffuse envelope, and at some stage it goes through a process that ejects that envelope, and that's what becomes a planetary nebula, and the core becomes the white dwarf. In some cases, if you look at the dynamics and the structure and the energy transport, you can't eject all the material. You're left with a denser than normal white dwarf atmosphere,
right,
which can then go through this process. But I don't think we really understand why, the details of why that happens. For example, the only way we've been able to explain the speed by which this object's evolved in this case was through by changing the buoyancy within the gas. So something, you know, the material inside the gas is pushed up to up into the upper layers by a buoyancy parameter. We don't really understand why the buoyancy should be different in some stars to others.
Right.
But that may be one of the reasons why you can drive the whole process.
Right.
In this particular way.
So this it sounds like, I mean, it sounds like a very interesting object. It's almost a unique opportunity to observe, as you say, stellar evolution in front of our eyes, which is not something we often get the chance to do, actually. I mean, what sorts of telescopes have been involved in studying Sakurai's object over the years since 96?
In fact, you should say, I mean, we actually put in our telescope proposals the once in a lifetime opportunity to observe this stage. So let me see what we used. I mean, incredible range of telescopes. Spitzer Space Telescope has observed this object looking at the dust, and we've used the UK infrared telescope, which is probably still the best, was at that point still the best infrared telescope on the planet. I believe we've used VLTI the VLTI observations as well. A very large array in North America attempting to again image the nebulosity originally, the big nebulosity originally extending, but now we're using it to probe through the dust. A number of optical telescopes in the early stages to do the spectroscopy within the first 5 years or so. But of course now, because it's a 24th magnitude, there's nothing we can do that. Southern African Large Telescope is an attempt to, again, peer through the dust and see what's happening there. We have monitoring observations with the Liverpool Telescope in order to just monitor it every so often so that we can catch the if the dust clears, we can catch it as soon as possible and follow up with
it. It would start to get brighter again at that point.
Get some multicoloured observations of that during that phase, but also trigger other observations,
right?
You know, some follow things like temperature changes in the dust, and, and see the star emerging from the dust if that happens.
Yeah.
The other example we have is what was noted as a Nova Aquila 1909, so it went off 100 years ago, and it spent 40 years inside the dust shell. So, you know, from that example, we may never see the star again in my lifetime, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, planetary nebulae are some of the most gorgeous structures that there are to look at, even just through a small telescope. But certainly, there's been some spectacular Hubble Space Telescope images of planetary nebulae. I mean, what are the images like of Sakurai's object?
Sakurai's planetary nebula is not a spectacular planetary nebula. It's because it's old. It's quite faint, and it's quite difficult. It's quite a distant object as well, so it's quite difficult to grab. To get a good image that gives you a very clear idea of the detailed structure. It's interesting that it appears to have a bit of bipolarity. So one of the things in planetary nebula research is how you get, you know, instead of them looking like a nice sphere, how you get ones that are extended in a particular direction. The famous one is Butterfly planetary nebula, for example. And there is still some idea that that might be due to underlining binary star, so two stars going around in the middle. Studies of Sakurai's object, which seems to have maybe a bipolar planetary nebula, suggest it isn't binary star, from all we can see. One suggestion, alternative suggestion for its origin, for why it's done the things it's done in the last 15 years, was that it was a merger of two stars. Now, there's very weak evidence for that, and it's probably not a favoured explanation, but of course, if it was a merger of two stars, then it would have been a binary beforehand. So, it's a difficult thing to get a handle on.
Are there any good predictions of when this thing's going to rebrighten, when the dust shell... Do we know what mass the dust shell is, for example?
We don't really have a very good idea of the mass of the dust shell. It turns out if you model this sort of dust shell, you can model where the inner radius is quite well, so where it is in relation to the star, but the outer radius is very difficult to estimate where that is, and therefore how much dust you've got. So the only really thing we've got is an observational estimate. It's going to be a few decades before it clears. Now we'll continue to make observations that allow us to see through and follow the star. As I say, the reheating at the current brightness might take 10 or 20 years, but that is one of the predictions of the different models, is how long that is, how hot it gets, and how quickly, and whether it then, you know, returns, cools down the white dwarf cooling track, which takes millennia, or returns back to the giant phase again in another few decades. So there's various observations you can make. The hope is that the dust will clear, it will expand to a point where it becomes transparent. There was some evidence a few years ago when we were still able to see the dust. The dust has cooled, so it's no longer easily visible with any of the telescopes we have.
Right.
It's in the sort of gap between the infrared and the millimetre now easily. But when it was still in the infrared, you could still see it in the infrared, there's some evidence it was still adding new dust. As the gas was expanding, it was going far enough out to cool down and form dust, and more dust was being added.
Right.
And more dust was being added, so that may be why it lasts so long.
Right.
Because although the outer dust disperses, you're still adding more dust in the dense parts inside.
Well, it sounds like, sounds like it's going to keep you busy for quite a few years yet.
Hopefully so, yes. Particularly if, as I said, the dust clears, that'll help us a lot. But we'll keep watching it. And as ever with these sorts of objects, you find other examples once you start to realise what they look like. We've found a few other examples, which we're going to try and do more systematic studies of, including very old novae that, when you look at them in detail, actually probably were this sort of object.
Dating back to
1600s.
Right, okay. Yeah. So these are very historical records of things that brightened in the sky. Yeah. Mm-hmm. People had no idea what they were. Mm-hmm. And this is a new idea for what those things might
be.
That's right.
And again, we've had predictions, but we've now theoretical predictions. But once we get an observational idea what they really look like and how they really change, you can go back and look at the details of what's going on.
Well, thanks very much for letting us know all about saccharized objects. Before we finish, I ought to ask, why is it called saccharized object?
Why is it called saccharized object? Yes, the person who discovered it in the sky is Yukio Sakurai, a Japanese amateur astronomer.
Okay.
And these sorts of objects are regularly found, novae in general, are regularly found by amateur astronomers. It's not the official name.
Right.
But because the official name is V4334 Sagittarius, which is a mouthful, saccharized object has become commonly used even by the professional astronomers.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not the only object he's discovered.
Right. So it's an interesting thing. I mean, astronomy is one of those sciences which you can actually make a significant contribution to as an amateur.
Yeah, in the old sense of being somebody doing it for the interest rather than just being a bit cack-handed, which is what amateur might come to mean, when it really doesn't mean
that. Certainly doesn't mean that in this case. It just means somebody who isn't paid to do that job in this case.
Absolutely vital to it.
Excellent. Okay, well, thanks again, Stuart, and we hope to hear from you again on the Jodcast sometime soon.
Oh, well, I'm happy to say it. Talk again, yes.